Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There are dual hearings in Washington today related to the ongoing investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The Senate Intelligence Committee is questioning current officials from Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, as well as state election officials. The House Intelligence Committee is questioning former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson. NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been listening in. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Robin.
And first of all, set the scene for us, will you? Because we've been hearing about so many investigations. We've been hearing about investigations into Russian interference in the election, as well as investigation into possible collusion with Russian interference by members of the Trump campaign. So where are we?
Right. The past week or two in particular, the focus was was there obstruction from the president or somebody in his administration blocking these investigations.
Right.
Today's dual hearings got back to the question of Russian interference and what it was trying to do, the computer hacking that it was doing into state election systems, and what did the government know about it last year.
And is it pretty much confirmed, is the widespread thinking on the part of these lawmakers, that there was Russian interference?
That has certainly been the consensus. And Jay Johnson, who was the head of Homeland Security until January, at the beginning of his testimony today, he said Russia interfered with our election. That's a fact, plain and simple. He wanted to be as clear as possible.
Right. And in his prepared testimony, this former Homeland Security Secretary Johnson said that, to his knowledge, the Russian government didn't alter ballots or ballot counts. Now, we have heard that before. It's thought no votes were altered. He seemed to confirm that today.
He did. That's still as far as he knows,
yeah.
But he's been out of office since the beginning
right.
of the year. So that's as far as he knows.
So did we find out more about what the Russians tried to do?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, what we learned I thought was most interesting, just the thought process, this delicate balance that he and others were trying to strike of alerting the public. Last summer, they knew this was going on, but not wanting to be seen as partisan or influencing the election. One really important point he made, may have forgotten, was Donald Trump was talking about the fact that this election might be rigged. They didn't want to be playing into this notion that the election was somehow being undermined. But they did want to alert people to the risk. And this was a balancing act they were playing all last summer and fall.
Well, he was also asked whether the Democratic National Committee asked his department for help after the committee was clearly hacked. And he said they didn't want his department's help at the time. Why?
Yeah, this was quite striking as well. He said on an almost daily basis, he was asking his staff, what are we doing about this hack into the DNC? And he kept getting the same response. The DNC had a conversation with the FBI. They say they've got a private security firm looking into it. They say they're good. They don't want our help. Johnson said in retrospect, he wished he had taken a sleeping bag and just camped out in front of the DNC headquarters seeking access so they could provide some assistance here.
Yeah. He also noted that some states were hesitant to get help from DHS after they had cybersecurity attacks. Here's what he had to say about that.
State election officials are very sensitive about what they perceive to be federal intrusion into their process. I heard that firsthand over and over. This is our process. It's our sovereign responsibility. We're not interested in a federal takeover.
Greg, what else did you hear that you want to share in the minute we have, and what are we going to look forward to?
Well, Jay Johnson said that, you know, when he came into office in 2013, counterterrorism was far and away his top priority. By the time he left this January, he felt cybersecurity was an equally important issue to be dealing with. That was the advice he gave to John Kelly. He said there needs to be much more work done with the states. Voter databases in particular are his main concern. He said there were some promising notes that most of these databases are kept off the internet, but he just says there needs to be a system of best practices, what works, what doesn't. He says the cyber threats are going to get worse before they get better.
Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, the status of more than two dozen national monuments across the country is currently under review by the Department of the Interior by order of President Trump. A national monument designation is designed to protect historic or natural resources on federal land. One of those being looked at is Giant Sequoia National Monument in the mountains of Central California. Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports.
Carla Kloer fell in love with giant sequoias as a kid, riding horseback through the forest. We're sitting on a log under the canopy of her favorite grove of giants in the monument, Belknap Grove.
Well, this place is really my heart's home. It's where I feel connection to the earth and to nature. I'm hoping that human beings will treasure it.
The 74-year-old's family homesteaded in the area, and she's fought to keep the 33 groves in the monument safe for decades. Kloer doesn't think the monument needs to be reviewed, and says if it loses its status, giant sequoias could be in danger.
Opening up these lands to commodity extraction, I believe, is the motive. Prior to the designation of the monument, these forests right here where you're sitting were in what they call the timber base.
In the executive order President Trump signed in April, he asked Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to look into a variety of things. Things like, are the monuments too big? Do they hurt the economy? And do people like them? The 328,000 Giant Sequoia National Monument was designated by former President Bill Clinton in 2000 and is managed by the Forest Service. Part of the fear of those opposing the review is that if the monument status is lost, it could open the door for logging or mineral exploration. Right now, there's no commercial logging allowed here, but they are cutting down trees killed by bark beetles around homes, roads, and campsites.
He's coming down slow! Away from the road!
Without the monument designation, Forest Service officials say loggers wouldn't be cutting down 2,000-year-old giant sequoias, mainly because of their historical significance. But environmental advocates like Carla Kloer say logging could still destroy the ecosystem around the big trees and, in the end, harm them.
You drive a bulldozer around the sequoias and you make it hotter and drier. You change the microclimate. And I say that you really have ensured the demise of those trees.
The president wouldn't have to get rid of all of the monument. He could rezone the boundaries of the monument for separate uses like logging. How the Forest Service is managed is a big part of the controversy over the monument. Eric LaPrice is a district ranger overseeing the monument. He says his crews haven't focused on thinning out dead trees near sequoia groves lately because of the lack of resources, even though the dead trees increase the risk of wildfire around the groves.
We had to prioritize. That does not mean we're forgetting about those areas that are not a direct threat to the public. Even though we have not been able to actively thin around the groves, we have been able to manage some fire on the landscape.
There have been several lawsuits over the monument, including one involving Tulare County Supervisor Steve Worthley. He doesn't think the Forest Service manages the monument well and says he explained that to Interior Secretary Zinke on a recent trip to Washington.
The monument has been a failure on the part of the Forest Service to administer the mission, which would be the protection of giant sequoias. You'll see a lot of dead trees surrounding the groves, so there's been nothing done to preserve or protect the groves.
Worthley says the giant sequoias should be protected, but he doesn't think they have to be within a monument to do so. He says the creation of the monument hurt the local economy, and he wouldn't mind if areas of it were open for activities like logging.
It had that effect of destroying an industry that had been in place since 1949. Since then, the Forest Service has taken basically a passive approach to forest management, which means do nothing.
But if the Secretary of Interior recommends dropping the Giant Sequoia's monument status, does President Trump really even have the authority to remove the designation?
There is not any precedent in history of a president acting through his executive authority revoking a national monument.
That's Bob Keiter. He's a specialist in public lands law at the University of Utah College of Law. He says if a president does that, it may present a legal problem because the Antiquities Act, which gives the president the right to create a monument, doesn't say much about stripping a monument of its status.
It does not include that authority because Congress didn't give it to him. There's the power to create, but not the power to modify or revoke monument designations.
Kider says if the Interior Secretary recommends a status loss, it would result in lawsuits and maybe even require a congressional vote. We reached out to the Department of the Interior for comment, but did not receive a response. Back in the giant Sequoia National Monument, under the trees along the middle fork of the Tule River, Carla Clower says she's not going to let her decades of defending these ancient giants go to waste.
I will keep fighting if the worst comes to pass. There will be a whole new generation of others that will fight, because if they undo the Sequoia Monument, there are many other national monuments and parks that they'll be after next.
In the meantime, as the monuments are being reviewed, the public can weigh in by filing comments until July 10th. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And let's get to the political news. Republican Karen Handel won by 5 points in the Atlanta suburbs over Democrat John Ossoff in that special House race last night. And Republican Ralph Norman won a different special House election in South Carolina, though Democrat Archie Parnell came closer than expected. This morning, President Trump tweeted, "Democrats would do much better as a party if they got together with Republicans on health care, tax cuts, security. Obstruction doesn't work." Let's bring in our Here and Now political analyst, Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, is with us as well. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have both of you. And I want to start with what you guys were tweeting last night. Starting with you, Jamal, you wrote, "I hope Dems listen to one clear message from 2016 in Ossoff. Anti-Trump is not enough. We need a plan to change the game for working people." Explain.
Absolutely. So I've been saying this since Hillary Clinton was running for president last fall, that the Democrats need to, and really before that, the Democrats need to have a message that is focused on the challenges that working people have, but is also aspirational. And the thing we have to remember is most Americans came to this country in order to do better than the place that they came from. They come from families where that's the case. Even African Americans who were brought here in chains, the ones who left the South and went North, went there because they were aspiring to a better life. Democrats have got to find a way to tap into that aspirational economic vision that Americans had. And frankly, President Trump did that in the last election. Democrats didn't. We just ran an anti-Trump campaign in the end. And the National Democratic Party is still being too anti-Trump and not focused enough on handling the economic problems real Americans have.
And you think John Ossoff did not do that?
I think John Ossoff tried to do it in his individual race. The problem is you've got a brand in the Democratic Party that has flaws. And so any individual is going to have trouble running underneath a flawed brand. And that's what Democrats have to fix, our national standing.
Are Democrats going to be able to pick what that brand is, given the divisions in the party right now?
Oh, I think that we're very united when it comes to the values of what we stand for, which is that everybody in the party gets to have an opportunity to succeed. We're going to find a way to focus on children and make sure that they have a chance, you know, in the education system. And there are all sorts of ways you can come at it. Individual candidates are going to run the races that are important for them. And that's another point, which is that we've got to find candidates that have a local street cred. They've got to be people who come from communities that already have a following in community, and then let's get behind them, not try to find some great trial lawyer or some great activist and build a constituency for that person.
Paris, you tweeted last night, "The clean GOP sweep tonight in GA6 and SC5 is a clear indictment on the failure of the Democratic Party in the age of Donald Trump. Make America great again."
Yeah, that's true. Listen, Democrats are in disarray. And I think what Jamal was pretty much saying is that you can't find a candidate who doesn't even live in the district to run for the congressional seat, nor can you rely on outside donations to make this the most expensive congressional race in history and think that the people in the district aren't going to have a voice. At the end of the day, this is what we know from this, from the race, especially in Georgia. One, the resistance movement is not resisting anything but the Democratic Party's platform. Two, we know that money alone can't buy you an election. And three, Republicans still support President Trump, his candidates, and people who want to carry the Trump message to Congress. Look, another thing that came out yesterday, Jeremy, was the fact that the GOP in May raised almost $11 million, which set another post-presidential record. There is enthusiasm on our side of the aisle. There are people who want to work with this president to get things done. And to Jamal's point about aspiration, the aspiration is also on the side side of the Republicans, because when the president talks about Make America Great Again, Hire American, Buy American, and all of these companies that are trying to do more to support American jobs, these are things that are aspirational and inspirational, and that is the enthusiasm that you see on the GOP side.
And just remember, resistance will get Democrats to 48%. We've now seen that in two elections. The way you get to 50, 51% is through vision. And that's the thing that we've been arguing about as a Democratic Party, is how to lay out that vision. But I will say this one last thing. Let's temper a little bit of the joy on the Republican side. This is a seat where Republicans won by 24 points in the past. Democrats closed that to about a 4-point margin. If that holds up in the seats we have to win next year, which are really 10-point seats, seats where Democratic candidates have lost by 10 points, that's a really bad omen for
Republicans. What about that, Paris?
Well, I think if you look at, if we want to be honest about this seat, they tried to make it a national election, an indictment on President Trump. But this seat, especially Georgia 6, President Trump, I believe, won it by one percentage point.
But President Trump is not what we're talking about. We're talking about congressional candidate versus congressional candidate, not presidential candidates.
Exactly. But I think that the notion to make this out to be a district that was overwhelmingly red, like Democrats like to change the narrative.
Are you kidding? That was Newt Gingrich's district.
It was Newt Gingrich's district. But if that was the case, if it was such a strong Republican stronghold, President Trump would have done a lot better in Georgia red. The point is, everyone thought Ossoff was going to win, and the momentum was on his side. He was young. He was attractive. He was very articulate. He had a message. He was inspirational to all these people. All these people, celebrities were coming in. But at the end of the day, what matters is you have to make this about a local election. You have to have a vision. You have to have a message. And it did not resonate with the people in Georgia 6.
Okay. Now, listen to this clip, because this is from the winner of that race, Karen Handel, speaking last night, thanking the president without using his name.
And a special thanks to the president of the United States of America.
So they're starting to shout Trump, 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 but she didn't use his name, Paris. What's that about?
I think everybody in America and around the world knows that Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States of America.
But why doesn't she use his name? I mean, are Republicans, even when they are able to win in the age of Trump, are they scared to associate themselves with him?
I support the president of the United States.
Okay.
And I pause, and you know exactly who I'm talking about, Donald J. Trump.
Well, no, there's no question about who you're talking about. But
there's no there there.
Right.
Jeremy, there's no there there.
Oh, there clearly is. I mean, what Karen Handel knows is that Donald Trump also is very flawed. And so they've got to be very careful how they go forward with the president. That could very well end up mired only in more muck going forward. And I just want to say one more thing about this election before we move any further is, you know, sometimes losing is okay. In 2006, Harold Ford Jr. lost an election for Senate in Tennessee against Bob Corker, but he lost it very narrowly. And what we learned in that election was that white voters will vote for an African-American candidate more even than they voted for previous white candidates. That election was a setup for Barack Obama in 2008, and it really gave us a lot of sense that he could win in the national election. So I think the Republicans get credit for the win. Congratulations. But let's not crow too much. There's a lot of things for Democrats to learn from.
But at the end of the day, Bob Corker is still a United States Senator, and Harold Ford is a commentator on TV in New York. So
yeah, but John McCain did not become president. What I'm saying is it's not about the individual election. You can lose an election. Congratulations. I'm not taking that away from you. What I'm saying is there are things to learn in an election even when you lose, and you ought to pay attention to those things.
Now he wants to make it about the presidential election. When I brought up the presidential election, he said, no, it's a local election. No, local elections matter. Corker won. Ford lost. That's the point.
Okay.
Carol Handel won.
Let's listen to Bob Corker. I'm glad you brought him up, because he was talking yesterday on MSNBC about the health care bill that is making its way through the Senate, the Republican health care bill, which is being done behind closed doors. Let's listen to Bob Corker.
You know, I would have liked, as you already know, for this to be a more open process and to have committee hearings, but that's not what we're doing. At the end of the day, that doesn't preclude my responsibilities as a senator to either vote yes or no based on the substance that's in it. And I certainly look forward to diving into that substance.
Jamal, as a Democrat, do you think that they're going to be able to get this bill passed through the Senate and repeal and replace Obamacare?
You know, they have a lot of vested interest in voting for a repeal of Obamacare. They ought to be very cautious about doing that, because this bill they're talking about, the Republican approach, is very unpopular in the country if you look at the polls. So they could get a bill passed. It might be the undoing of their majority, absolutely, if they do it. But they certainly could do it, for sure.
Paris, what do you think?
I think the Republican Party is very aware of the fact that we have to do well in 2018, and we want this winning streak to continue. And so this Obamacare repeal and replace is going to be an important factor in those elections. But more importantly, it's about the American people. And so I believe the Senate is going to do the right thing and try to have consensus and do something that's going to actually benefit the American people and give them something that is better. And so whether it's behind
Does that those, mean this bill, or are you saying that you think that they're going to come up with something else?
Well, I think every indicator from all the senators, especially the Republican senators, have said that they're going to do something that's different, because a lot of people did not like the bill that came out of the House, which is fine. But at the end of the day, as long as we get something that is a good bill, a better bill for the American people, that's what the voters want. And I believe that's what the president at the end of the day wants. Because remember, he's not an ideologue. He's going to make Republicans upset. He's going to make Democrats upset. He's going to go for the good deal. And I think the Senate knows that.
On the merits, this bill is going to be garbage. It will cause voters' health care prices to go up. Medicaid folks will lose coverage, and it will be something that people look back at and long for the days of Obamacare if it actually gets implemented.
Well, what if it is close to the health care bill that passed through the House, Paris, and it does send 20-some million people off their health care? What's the consequence of that for Republicans if that's what happens?
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. But, if we want to play hypotheticals, what we have to ask the question is fundamentally, do you want to have affordable care, or do you want to have just access? And I think it's the access versus affordability is the question that we're going to ask. And remember, before Obamacare, these people weren't on it. So this doom and gloom is not very valid. We have to be honest with what we are facing. And Obamacare premiums are rising every single day. We saw what happened in Iowa. And so we have to be very honest about this debate. Obamacare is not perfect. It needs to be changed. It needs to be amended. How far you go is what the Senate has got to figure out today and next coming days.
That's Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, both Here and Now political analysts. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Prodigy, half of the rap duo Mobb Deep, died yesterday after being admitted to a Las Vegas hospital with complications from sickle cell anemia. Born Albert Johnson, Prodigy was diagnosed as an infant, suffered terrible pain. His death is a reminder of this terrible disease. Sharon Begley is a senior science writer for STAT. She joins us by Skype. And Sharon, you've written about it. We'll link people. But what is sickle cell anemia?
So sickle cell is an inherited disease. It is the result of a genetic mutation, and people who inherited the mutated form of the gene from both parents, one from mom, one from dad, have the actual disease. If you inherited only one, you're a carrier. And what the mutation does is cripple your red blood cells. They become cramped, sickle shape, and they are unable to carry oxygen, which of course is the function of red blood cells. So as you might imagine, when there is less oxygen being delivered to your organs throughout your body, there are horrific consequences. Robin, you used the word terrible pain, and that is definitely one of the consequences. So is complete organ failure. So this is not a gentle disease by any means. It is truly awful, and approximately 100,000 people in the United States and, of course, many more worldwide have it.
Well, and Prodigy talked about, being a child, feeling an attack coming on at the bus stop and, knowing that he was going to have pain. It's like a migraine, apparently, in every part of your body. It's that painful. So we've known about it for a while. It largely affects the African-American community. And you spoke with doctors who said they just needed $5 million for a clinical trial. As you said, this is like a rounding error for a lot of researchers. It's such a small amount in the world of research. And there are some who feel that the reason we haven't had better results and more research is because it affects, African-Americans.
Well, and that was one of the questions that I set out to answer. And as you might imagine, when I posed that question to people, why has there been so little progress? most of them tiptoed around that. But I reached one of the grand old men of hematology, and he said outright, because of who it affects. Not only African-Americans, but Greeks, Italians, who over the decades in this country have frankly not been favored groups. And the sad fact is that when hospitals approach would-be donors, you know, can you write us a big check? That money tends to go to, if it's going to a children's disease, to cancer. Mm-hmm. And hospitals told me they just have a terrible time raising money for sickle cell research.
Well, meantime, you've done a very deep article, and it sounds as if that there might be some genetic way to turn off switches that make these cells work better or at least alleviate the pain. I mean, how close do these doctors feel they are if they could just get some research?
Yes, there is a gene therapy trial being run by the Massachusetts-based biotechnology company Bluebird. And the Bluebird trial has had some success in fixing the genetic defect that we described earlier. There's another approach. People who have the mutation that causes sickle cell but have an additional mutation, they seem to be fine. They carry both mutated genes by all rights. They should have the disease, but they don't. So another approach is to sort of paradoxically give them another mutation so that the bad mutation in one gene, they will have a sort of compensatory one in another gene. And some academic labs are also trying to get clinical trials up and running.
Okay. Well, and the death of Prodigy reminds us, you know, how much it's needed. Sharon Begley, senior writer for Stat News. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And it's the holy month of Ramadan. Muslims rising early to eat a huge meal, then fasting till dusk, breaking that fast with another meal often shared. Well, in Southern California, Muslims are breaking that fast with tacos and sharing it with Latinos. In the Taco Trucks at Every Mosque campaign, partly a pushback to the words of Mexican immigrant and Latinos for Trump founder Marco Gutierrez on MSNBC last September.
My culture is a very dominant culture. And it's imposing and it's causing problems. If you don't do something about it, you're going to have taco trucks every corner.
Well, joining us now, the organizers of Taco Trucks at Every Mosque, Rida Hamida, chair of the Cultural and Heritage Commission with the City of Anaheim, California. Hi, Rida.
Hi.
She's joining us from the studios of KUCI in Irvine. While we welcome Ben Vasquez, also an activist and a history teacher at Valley High School in Santa Ana. He joins us from his classroom. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
What did you think when you heard that phrase, there might be taco trucks on every corner?
I thought that was great. I visit taco trucks often. I love it. And I was just worried about him criminalizing or making like taco trucks are a bad thing and Latinos are a bad thing. That was really, it was upsetting.
Well, and not only that, I don't know if I'm wrong about this, but I think people love taco trucks. Rida, where did you come up with the idea, as a Muslim, to cross-pollinate mosques with taco trucks?
So Ben Vasquez and I, as well as organizers of this movement called Latino Muslim Unity, sat down together and talked about different ways of engaging these two communities. Well, you know, I actually asked Ben, I said, so, you know, for the month of Ramadan, I would really like Latinos to invite Muslims to break fast. What kind of restaurant would you take them to? And it's really important in this movement to understand that not all Muslims are Arabs. So when you know that Muslims are everyday people, they're Asians, they're African Americans, they're Latinas, they're Latinos, it's hard to say that this is the first time that Latinos and Muslims are sharing a meal because we're everywhere.
Yeah. Well, but it may be the first time for some of the people who come to these events. Now, we know you've had a few of them already. You bring these taco trucks to mosques for iftar, the meal in which Muslims break their Ramadan fast at the end of the night. And so what's happened?
So we really wanted to embrace that idea that there was a fear that there would be a taco truck at every corner in this month of Ramadan, and the Muslims really are experiencing a lot of injustice. And so we wanted to embrace the Latino community as well as their culture in this month to really fight that injustice in the most delicious way possible, one halal taco at a time.
Halal, by the way.
Halal actually means permissible in Arabic. So halal is a type of meat that the animal is slaughtered in the name of God without causing any suffering for the animal. And there's no hormones or the animal itself has to be in good health. And it's really a really healthy way of eating.
And Ben, as part of this cultural exchange, was this something that was new to you, learning about the kinds of meat?
It is very new to me, and I was thankful to be part of it and learn about like this meat, and you're enjoying your food in a different way because the thoughtfulness, the understanding of it, of how it comes and how it comes to your table.
Well, and Rida, I know you've had events, one at the Islamic Society of Orange County, more than 1,400 people showed up. You'd served 2,400 tacos. Another was at the Islamic Center of Santa Ana. More than 400 people attended there. Who's coming?
Well, everybody and their mother. It was really beautiful to see a multicultural representation of Muslims as well as our allies, not just Latinos. There was the LGBT community. There were Jews. There were Christians, Catholics that really wanted to share in this solidarity movement. So we didn't just get a gourmet taco truck. We made every effort. Ben and I, actually Ben's the one that found the taco truck, literally at a corner in Santa Ana. And we worked with the taco truck owner and asked him if he would be willing to use halal meat. And he didn't understand what that meant. And we just let him know that means like the way the meat is slaughtered adheres to Islamic law. And he really was open and so happy to serve the Muslim community in this month. And he even said himself, now he wants to purchase halal meat and serve it at the taco truck.
Well, let's hear some sound from your event in Santa Ana. KPCC went, and it shows you're not just sharing food, but you're also able to share culture. You were both on stage and speaking, both Rida and Ben. Let's listen.
How do you say coffee?
Café.
That's kahwa. How do you say God willing?
Ohala.
You say inshallah. What about oil?
I say that.
You say zayt.
So you are having a cultural exchange as well. And Ben, I know you have a saying, la cultura cura. What is that?
That when you're strong in your own culture, it makes you resilient. The culture will cure you. So when you have two minority groups uplifting each other and celebrating the other group, that builds resiliency in between that person and himself and as a community. Because you're saying, look how great these things are. As you're being talked about in a negative way, as you're being trying to be pushed out, you're uplifting and saying, no, you're beautiful the way you are. We're going to celebrate you. And that builds resiliency in people.
Let's listen to Lucy Silva. This is from CBS News. She attended the event in Santa Ana. She's a Latina Muslim, was wearing a hijab, and she was concerned about a rise in hate crimes against Muslims. Let's listen.
Being here and sharing our stories of being immigrants and having to deal with everyday issues about the stereotypes that everybody encounters on a daily basis, and we all have that in common.
And Rida and Ben, a report by the Council on American Islamic Relations did find a rise in anti-Muslim incidents, 57% in the last year compared with the year prior. Where you both live in Orange County, the Orange County Human Relations Commission also found a rise in hate crimes. Yes, 14% were African American, 10% members of the LGBT community, but 35% were against Muslims, 18% against Latinos. You do have something in common there.
It's really important to raise awareness about our struggles and the injustices that we both experience, but also to get to know one another and to defend one another. So I, being a proud Palestinian Muslim American born in Burbank, California, I'm a proud California girl. It's very hard for a lot of the Trump supporters to hear me say that. It makes them very uncomfortable.
Wait, how do you know that? I mean, do they come to your events?
Well, actually, one of the things that I have experienced personally is quite a few hate incidents. I mean, I've been told to go back to Iraq, which I'm not Iraqi. It's times where I've been driven off the road.
Do you wear a head covering? So
I am a hijabi. Yeah. I wear the hijab. And so last week, there were Trump supporters, and they were actually videotaping me while I was videotaping and speaking to other people. And they had their Trump shirts, and they approached me, and I actually invited them to tacos, and they politely accepted, and they ate our food, and they were quiet. And so eating halal tacos really did combat hate.
Ben, again, you've also felt hate talk, or at the very least, sort of inferring that people of Mexican heritage were going to swamp this country with taco trucks on every corner. What did you feel when you went to these events?
I feel inspired and grateful. It's just humbling to be there with other folks and for them to bring you into your house after you've been depicted as a criminal and a rapist, these people that are coming from other, you know, from another country, and for people to let us come into their place, and one of the most spiritual times with open arms, and I loved every minute of it.
It's so interesting. You're the child of Mexican immigrants. Rida, you're the child of Palestinian immigrants. Did you ever think you'd intersect?
Not this closely. I knew I would have co-workers, some friends, but to be working and organizing in a mosque for the betterment of other communities, this is just awesome, and it's a great feeling to be part of it.
Ben, I have an honest question. So before this Latino Muslim unity effort that I invited you to, did you know anything about Muslims?
I knew what I knew from history books, very little. You don't cover too much. I am a history teacher, but this, the intricacies, the cultural aspects, just things about Ramadan and how to behave and why things are done, and better understanding of Muslim folks, this is an eye-opener, and it's a great experience.
Yeah. Well, Ben Vasquez, again, a history teacher at Valley High School in Santa Ana. Rida Hamida, community activist and chair of the Cultural and Heritage Commission with the City of Anaheim, California. Both of them, the force behind tacos in every mosque. Thank you so much for talking to us about it. Rida, happy Ramadan.
Thank you so much.
Ben, thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Saudi Arabia's stock market closed up more than 5% today after 81-year-old King Salman appointed his 31-year-old son, Mohammed bin Salman, crown prince, the next in line to the throne. Prince Mohammed bin Salman is the country's defense minister, and the previous crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, has been removed. He worked with Washington in the push against terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. The shakeup comes as Saudi Arabia grapples with low oil prices, a rivalry with Iran, a war in Yemen, and a rift with Qatar. Gregory Gause is a professor of international affairs at the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M University. He joins us via Skype. Gregory Gause, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is the significance of today's news?
It ends a good bit of uncertainty in Saudi Arabia. There have been rumors for years that the king was going to replace the crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, with the king's own son, Mohammed bin Salman. And in that sense, that might be reflected in the Saudi stock market going up. On the other hand, this is a concentration of power in the hands of one prince that Saudi Arabia hasn't seen for 50 years.
Well, what do we know about him? What do we know about Prince Mohammed bin Salman? He's been seen by some as a reformer, but others see him as power hungry.
Well, I think you'd have to be both. If you're going to change a place like Saudi Arabia with well-entrenched traditions and a conservative reputation, you're going to have to concentrate power in the hands of one person. The problem, of course, of concentrating power is that that one person might not have the best ideas.
He worked on this thing called Saudi Vision 2030, which was a plan to diversify the country's economy and reduce its dependence on oil. Did he do well in that regard? Or, I mean, Saudi Arabia is still pretty much reliant on oil, right?
Oh, it's certainly. It's an oil state. Vision 2030 is Mohammed bin Salman's baby, and he will rise and fall to some extent by its success or failure. It's too early to tell right now. Part of Vision 2030 is imposing some austerity on the Saudi population, just less money to go around. And that, of course, led to some negative feedback. And he's backed away from some of the elements of the Vision 2030. There's also serious issues about how to change the labor market in Saudi Arabia, where there's so many foreign workers. And right now, Vision 2030 hasn't solved that problem yet.
What might he do on social and human rights issues in Saudi Arabia? We should note that a report from the NGO Freedom House has listed Saudi Arabia as the 9th least free society in the world.
Right. And I think they've moved up a couple steps from previous years. This is not a democracy by any stretch of the imagination, and it's not a place with liberal conceptions of human and individual rights. And Mohammed bin Salman is not going to change that. I think that on the social side, some people in the United States might see him as a reformer. He certainly wants to open up Saudi social life a bit in terms of public entertainments in this very conservative society. And there are indications that he would like to see women play a greater role in public life in Saudi Arabia. But of course, there's going to be pushback on that as well.
They can't drive right now, correct?
Exactly. It's the only country in the world where women are not permitted to drive.
And what does this mean for the ongoing war in Yemen, which Saudi Arabia is very involved in? And Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been right at the forefront of that.
Right. No change on Yemen. Prince Mohammed is the defense minister. He remains as defense minister. He was the face of the Yemen war. And so I don't see any great change in Yemen. What we might see is a solution to the, or at least a short-term solution to the Qatari issue, because the United States has expressed its impatience with the Saudis. And I don't think Mohammed bin Salman wants to start off his new position with problems with the United States.
Now, the King of Saudi Arabia, as we said, is 81. Prince Mohammed is 31, which means, you know, all things being equal, he could be in charge of Saudi Arabia for decades from now. What does this mean for the United States?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman has been on a campaign in the last few years to have himself be better known among American policymakers. He visited with President Trump. He basically arranged with Jared Kushner President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia. So clearly, Mohammed bin Salman doesn't want to distance Saudi Arabia from the United States. The question is, does his leadership style, his willingness to go outside of American-approved foreign policy initiatives, as he did in Yemen, will that lead to tensions? So it's not that he wants to distance himself from the U.S., but will his leadership style fit with the way the United States wants its policy in the Middle East to run?
How do you think this news is going down today in Tehran?
Not well. Tehran sees Mohammed bin Salman as very much against them, and for good reason. He's publicly said that he wants to carry the fight against Iran into Iran because he believes that Iran has been trying to carry its fight against Saudi Arabia into Saudi Arabia. And so I think that this just exacerbates what is already a very tense situation between Iran and Saudi Arabia across the Middle East, Syria, Yemen, the Gulf, Iraq.
That's Gregory Gause, who's a professor of international affairs at the Bush School of Government at Texas A&M University. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.